I'll call the meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is Thursday, February 1st at 3:32 p.m. We are in the Belts Committee Room in Juneau, Alaska. Wanted to remind folks to please turn off their cell phones. Members present today, we have Senator Merrick, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Bjorkman, and myself, Chair Kawasaki. I'd like to thank Savannah Danbert from Senate Records and Shelby Carroll, the moderator from the Legislative Information Office, for being here today. On today's agenda, we have two items. The first one is Senate Bill 159, Alaska Veterans Poppy Day, sponsored by Senator Dunbar. And we also have Senate Bill 177, Artificial Intelligence, Deepfake, Cybersecurity, and Data Transfers, sponsored by Senator Hughes. First, we will take up Senate Bill 159, and if Senator Dunbar and his staff,
good timing,
Seth Tagarian, will come up and present the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I apologize. Some documents we need to distribute now. We had a problem with the printer, and so that's why we have my very out of breath staffer here. But thank you so much for hearing this bill. It's a pretty simple bill. SB 159 establishes Alaska Veterans Poppy Day on the Friday before Memorial Day. So the poppy has been used as a symbol of remembrance for fallen members of the military, actually going back to the late 1600s. But it became most prominent during World War I. So many of you have probably heard of In Flanders Field, which was written by Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae on May 3rd, 1915. He was presiding over a funeral of Lieutenant Alexis Helmer. So the Veterans of Foreign Wars conducted the first distribution of these poppies in 1922, before Memorial Day. But even before that, it became the official flower of the American Legion in 1920. We have someone online who will speak from the American Legion who will speak more to this. But I see this as a way to honor our fallen veterans, for people to remember sort of what the purpose of Memorial Day is. And your Memorial Day weekend is sort of morphed in our culture to a time of barbecues and family, and it's great. It's great that that's the case. But we always have to remember what it was originally for. And establishing Veterans Poppy Day, I think, is one way to do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, we have a very brief sectional that Seth can run through. And then if we could, Ms. Austenice, I believe, is online. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Tagarian.
For the record, Seth Tagarian, staff to Senator Dunbar. I know that you can all read, so I'm not even going to turn to this page that the sectional is on. Section 1 will amend Alaska statutes to add Alaska Veterans Poppy Day on the Friday before Memorial Day every year, and Section 2 establishes the effective date as soon as both bodies manage to pass it. Any questions?
Great.
I appreciate all your patience on my quest today.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the sponsor of the bill or staff? I guess I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Is the Friday immediately preceding Memorial Day of each year, is there any other special day that can be attributed to?
To the chair, I do not believe that there's an Alaska holiday on that day.
Great. Thank you. Do we have any other questions for the sponsor of the bill or staff? Okay, hearing none, we'll go ahead and open up invited and public testimony. We do have somebody who's called in online for a couple minutes now. We have Ms. Jeannie Austenice, who is well-known in the Capitol. She is currently the president of the American Legion Auxiliary, the Jack Henry Unit Number 1 in Anchorage. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Kawasaki and members of the State Affairs Committee for hearing Senate Bill 159. I am Jeannie Austenice, and I am president of the unit at Jack Henry Post 1, Our auxiliary is 100 years old this year, from July to July. And basically, we've had continuous service for self and not, I mean, for veterans and not self. this May is National Poppy Day. It was set forth by the American Legion in 2017. This National Poppy Day is, of course, celebrated for in every state, and now it is a way to show that the state is in appreciation of the armed services, not only for their service in November, but also sacrifice in May. So the poppy is used throughout the year, but the special days are, Memorial Day weekend, and also Veterans Day. The Veterans of Foreign Wars was the first organization to organize a nationwide distribution of poppies, and they led that distribution just before Memorial Day in 1922. They adopted it as their flower, calling it the Buddy Poppy at that year, too. The American Legion had the poppy that you see in the room starting in 1920, but it did not become a national program until 1924, 100 years ago. The National Poppy Day was started in 2017, and the American Legion family is the organization that brought it to the United States Congress. So nationally, if Friday before Memorial Day is National Poppy Day, and to have it Alaska identifying it as a state remembrance, I think it is just something that brings forward to the populace that we are showing our appreciation of not only the sacrifice, but service. Our unit is about 200 strong, and our post, post one, is about 800 here locally in Alaska. For the American Legion, we order approximately 23,000 poppies statewide. My unit uses about 8,000. And through numerous volunteers and many hours, those crepe poppies are taken from a flat flower into a blossom. We put five of them together, and they go on white crosses to approximately 1,450 graves at the Anchorage Memorial Park Cemetery. So before Memorial Day, these crosses go up and are a wonderful visual contact for people who can see these graves that are scattered throughout that park cemetery. There are other organizations that are supporting this bill. We have not only our department, American Legion Auxiliary, AMVETS has a resolution. We have the Jack Henry Squadron, which are the sons of veterans. And there's also a 40 and 8 society, which is a World War I society that basically services the nurses any way they can, scholarship-wise. Idea of this Poppy Day encourages people to emphasize here in Alaska to wear this and display the poppy as a symbol of remembrance and hope. The poppy's reputation as a symbol of remembrance, as you see in the sponsor statement, begins in earlier, but stronger in World War One, after World War One. So connecting that visual image of the poppy with sacrifice and service made by our veterans has been an important part of the American Legion program, as well as the VFW and AMVETS and disabled DAV as well. The poppy funds must be used only for the welfare of veterans and active duty military when a financial or medical necessity exists. These poppies are distributed at the request of the person receiving them to just make a donation. They are never for sale, and it is all to the support of future veterans and active military personnel and their families. The auxiliary for many years has been spouses, which are of a veteran, a mother, a daughter, a sister, a grandmother, granddaughter of a veteran. That has changed some now that we have women in the military. Men are also a part of the auxiliary. For the structure of the American Legion, post is veterans. The sons are sons of the veterans, and then they are also riders that are part of the post. But the auxiliary is a separate organization, but we work very closely with the post. Let's see, the other people that have sent a letter of support is the National Warriors Foundation. And the executive director basically says that through her organization, she's supporting this bill in full support of the Poppy Day and legislation aiming to establish the day dedicated to honoring and expressing gratitude for the commitment of both past and current armed forces. And she goes on to say that this legislation provides a chance for community involvement and expressing appreciation. It creates a platform for citizens to contribute to donating poppies with proceeds supporting the veterans and their families. Supporting the Alaska Veterans Poppy Day Act reinforces the importance of recognizing dedication, bravery, and sacrifices made by our veterans. It also presents an opportunity to educate future generations about the significance of honoring those who have defended the values we hold dear. There are numerous countries around the world that can celebrate Poppy Day. So some are in November on Veterans Day, and some are in May for Memorial Day. So that concludes my testimony, and I'm available for any questions, and I appreciate you hearing this bill, and on the behalf of the veterans, thank you for caring.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Austinus. Are there any questions for Ms. Austinus at this time? Okay. Thank you once again for your testimony today. Let's see, anybody online who'd like to testify on the bill, and anybody in the room who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 159 at this time? Okay. Hearing none, public testimony and invited testimony will be closed. So are there any final questions of members before we set the bill aside? Okay, hearing none, we're going to hold...
Senator Dunbar.
Oh, yeah. Do you have a... Senator Dunbar, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wondering if I can make a brief concluding remark.
Oh, of course.
I just wanted to say thank you very much for hearing this bill. I was remiss. I forgot to mention that this summer I went with the Alaska Army National Guard to Fort Riley, Kansas. Actually, to Camp Funston, which is within Fort Riley, Kansas, which is the origin of the flu pandemic, which is a fun fact. But... we went to the World War I Museum in Kansas City, and if you ever get a chance to go, I highly recommend it. It's an incredible, moving place that sort of shows the horrors of that war. And when you walk into it, you walk over a glass bridge, and under the bridge are thousands of red poppies. And that sort of drove home to me the importance of this legislation. So thank you very much for hearing it. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you, Senator Dunbar, and thank you, Mr. Tagarian, for presenting Senate Bill 159 to the committee. Let's see, if no final questions, we're going to go ahead and sit Senate Bill 159 aside at this time. And if you'd like, we would like to take amendments for 159. They're due to my office by February 5th, which is Monday, the 5th at 5 p.m. So we will take a brief at ease, and the sponsor of the next bill, Senate Bill 177, will come forward. I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee back to order. The time now is 3:51 in the afternoon. We now have, we'll now take up Senate Bill 177 relating to artificial intelligence, deepfakes, cybersecurity, and data transfers. With us today, we have Senator Shelley Hughes, the sponsor of the bill, and her staff, Stephen Knaus. We also have several folks online, including Ian Walsh from Ledge Legal, Heather Hebden, available for questions from the Alaska Public Offices Commission. We have several folks, which I'll introduce, who are also with us on Teams, who will present various aspects of the bill. And so if Senator Hughes, if you'd like to begin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator and Chair Kawasaki, and members of the committee for hearing 177, SB 177 today. I just want to say, in sum, when you think what it's mainly about artificial intelligence and political deepfakes, it's basically about all about transparency and fair practices, and it's all about informing and protecting Alaskans, so in, on both fronts. And we kind of think of it as AI as something that's brand new, and there's a lot of talk about it, but actually, it was in 1950, so even before I was born, there was a paper written by a guy named Alan Turper, and it was called Computing Machinery and Intelligence. And 6 years later, there were three guys who put together a program called the Logic Theorist, which mimicked human problem-solving skills, 1956. And it was funded by the Rand Corporation and was presented at a conference entitled Dartmouth Summer Research Project. And you think it might have taken off. It fizzled a little bit. But fast forward ahead, and oh, I want to say at that 1956 conference, forgot to mention the term artificial intelligence, AI, was actually coined. So now fast forward ahead, you know, it's nearly 75 years, and we call it a new frontier. And so the question is, why do we call it a new frontier when it's almost been around 75 years? Well, I think it's because we can all guess it's evolving at a pace like we've not seen before and with capabilities not known before. And the systems, the models are emerging and improving daily. And the momentum is quite historic and revolutionary. And we all know that it's here and we can't stop it. So it's becoming part of our lives. And some people don't realize it, but every time you use your map on your smartphone, you are using AI. You're being assisted by AI. And as I'm out and about, and perhaps you've had conversations with Alaskans, the emotions range from fear when they think of AI to excitement. They range from joyful anticipation of what's going to be next to worrisome anxiety. So what we're doing here is we understand that as policymakers, we have to realize this is just another tool, and we have to realize that it's our job to safeguard the public where it might be necessary and guard against bad actors. And we also have to understand that there's real potential to streamline work processes, and but we would, as we put this in, bill is very much about state agency use. Setting out that transparency and guidelines is an important role for us. And when you can think about the vast amount of data that state agencies have about Alaskans, think PFD applications, driver's license information, professional licensing, you know, court records, just it goes on and on. So they have a vast amount of data. So we want to make sure as that data is inputted into algorithms and gets spit out the other end as outputs that may impact some decisions, we want to make sure that that is very well protected. And then the last thing besides state agency use we'll be talking about is actually a subset of artificial intelligence, and that is particularly important this year as election year, are political deepfakes. And with the ease of access more and more every day to systems that would allow a deepfake to be generated, I think it's really important we get a handle and have that conversation. So with that, we're going to go through this presentation. We're going to, you want to flip? And one of the things, I don't know about you, but one of the things when I watch PowerPoints, Mr. Chair, I read it in my mind a lot faster than the person is saying. So we're going to try not to read it because you're all intelligent, you can read. But this is a definition that is pulled from numerous places. You mentioned Ian. Ian is on the phone, our drafter. We had a lot of fun drafting this. It's kind of a new area for Ledge Legal. But this is a fairly well accepted definition of artificial intelligence. So go to the next slide. So now the question is, why are we doing this now and why here? We kind of alluded to in my opening remarks, it's moving, AI is moving at lightning speed. But one thing, I have been saying this, and I said, I should just put this as my quote because I keep saying it's a tool that is not inherently evil in itself. It is not. And so for the people that fear it, that's a really important principle for folks to understand. But we do have to safeguard against bad actors, and we want to harness it for good, particularly for state agency use. So why are we doing it here, and why is this a conversation in state capitals across the U.S.? It's because Congress moves very slowly, and it's not expected they'll unite and get on the page to get anything done. Although with the recent Taylor Swift deepfake, maybe they will get something done on that front. So there's a lot of conversations. I've been serving on the National Conference of State Legislatures Task Force on AI, and we've had access to a lot of very smart people. But one of the advantages of a state doing is we can respond more quickly. We can customize it and work for our state. And so we're just able to get it done more easily. So next. So again, the two main focus areas are going to be state agency use of AI in the bill, and the second is the political deepfakes. And why is this? I will just, the background is, as I have been on this task force and thinking about it, listening to Alaskans, for one thing, we're a small state, and I don't want to stifle innovation. So anybody that might be a developer that might be creating an AI tool that would be useful, I didn't want to go after the private sector. That just is not, you know, what I am. And that was the same thing way back in when we did the drone legislation, the same thing. We want to allow innovation. It's very important. And it would be a fool's errand anyway if we tried to go after vendors because we're such a small population. If we told vendors you have to do this and this and that, they'd say, well, I guess we won't do business in Alaska. So that focusing on state agencies use, I think, is the right step. And I think the public would appreciate it. And having a conversation this morning with the Chief Information Officer at the Department of Administration, who is excited to present to you on this, they are beginning to rock and roll. They have a work group, and he will share with you. There's going to be some AI tools launched soon by Microsoft specific for state government use, and so it is definitely something that it's time. It is time to address this before they launch. And then, of course, political deepfake. It goes without saying. We've got elections around the corner. And, you know, I hope that we don't get to a world where every time we look at a photo, every time we look at a video, we're going to wonder if it's reality or not reality. But we could get there. And I think it's important to have a sense of knowing that we can trust whether something is true or not true. Because if we get to that point where we can't, it's going to create chaos. And I'm very concerned about our constitutional republic and the whole election process in that regard. And you can scan up and down. I'm not going to read these, but these were kind of the principles as I've been studying and learning and kind of where I wanted to go with this. This is not an exhaustive list. I do want to point out the one that you might not know what it means when it says embrace data hygiene. That has to do with you only collect what you need, and you only keep it for as long as you need it. Once your task is done, you don't store it. So it's and I'm talking to our chief information officer, I think that's a principle even outside of artificial intelligence that they abide by. This one below that regarding bias, that's something that you have to really watch for, and so the human oversight is going to be important for that. So next slide, and I think I'm going to hand it over if you want to, Stephen.
All right. For the record, Stephen Nouse, aide to Senator Hughes. What we're doing here is we're just looking at a high level of what this bill does. We want to add disclosure statements requirements for political deepfake communications. So that way it's, while we can't automatically know that something is a deepfake using just software, this will be another stopgap to identify when deepfakes are used, so we engender a little bit more trust into the public. We want to add new sections regarding state agency use of artificial intelligence and individuals' data, just trying to get that established to, again, bolster the trust that we have their best interests at heart. And then the third one is add sections to allow individuals who suffer harm from to bring civil actions to a superior court. So what this bill does...
Before you go on and go back to that one, just very quickly, this is Shelley Hughes back on the record. I just want to mention, of course, you as the committee and the chair are free to do what you wish. This does have a referral to judiciary, so you might choose to focus on one and two, and number three would be for the judiciary. But so I just kind of point that out because, and I didn't say this earlier, and I should have, this bill is a work in progress. Sometimes as legislators, we refine a bill back and forth. We get it vetted or during the interim and work with LegLegal to get the language. This took a little longer for LegLegal. We didn't, and we felt like it needs to be before you and really get the conversation started. So there, we already have a list of things that we, in talking to different folks, that we know need to be improved. So there's a lot of opportunity for you all to do some amendments if you so choose. So I just point out that number three, you might want to let judiciary do it. But anyway, that's kind of the way we see it.
For the record, Stephen Nouse. We would continue to look a little bit more. This bill requires a biannual inventory and report of AI systems that will be used by the state agencies, published on the website. You can see some of the requirements listed under there. And it does require a biannual impact assessment published on the website for each of those agencies that uses it. Impact assessment. Not going to read that entire list, but there are things there that will be the indicators. Is this safe? Is this good? Are we handling the data correctly? So, next slide. It also requires on the state agency side specific things that we're requiring for them, notifying individuals who the use of AI might affect, obtaining their consent before soliciting or acquiring sensitive information, things like that. So, such as the Department of Public Safety sharing information required by law with the court system. We're just wanting to make sure that there's transparency there.
Okay, let me explain that one. Because if it is required by law for the data to be shared, for instance, Department of Public Safety sharing information to the courts, consent would not be required. That's what that asterisk was about. But and we did have a conversation with the chief information officer. And when you go into My Alaska, the file for your PFD or all the different things, there are 42 different applications through that process. So that is actually shared across numerous departments. So that section of the bill, we're probably going to have to fix it as an example of one of the things we've learned to make it work.
All right, and then finally, what we're trying to prohibit state agencies from doing is collecting extra information, as the senator had mentioned before, but things like biometric identification, using facial recognition, cognitive behavioral manipulation, things like that are in the list.
So just to summarize the state agency, these are kind of things that we were looking and just sums up being transparent. We want the public to know if the state agency is using artificial intelligence for something, that they can explain those impact assessments. Assessments would actually be a way to keep the public informed why it's beneficial? And are they mitigating any risks? Those kind of things. And the conservative, again, is that data hygiene. When you look at AI, the human oversight is important at all the various stages. So a developer, of course, is somebody who's creating the model or the system. The deployer is sometimes a vendor who's getting it out there, and then the user would be a state agency. However, when Bill Smith, the chief information officer, speaks to you, he may tell you that they are planning to be the developer for some of the artificial intelligence. So they might be actually creating the model and system they would be used. And just as a really rolling back, artificial intelligence, you know, it started in the 50s. But when you think about it, there's artificial intelligence. We usually think of generative AI because that's what everybody's talking about. And that's the stuff that's the pace is picked up. But rule-based AI is an Excel sheet. So that is artificial intelligence too, that you're feeding data in and then they're spitting things out. So that's another thing we might want to narrow this, some of these things down. In fact, the fiscal note from Department of Administration is very high because they included all the rule-based in there. And that's, you know, I think the public is comfortable with that. That's a very precise thing, but it's the generative AI. We kind of want to make sure we have good checks and balances. So if we narrow the scope to generative AI in this bill, that should bring down that fiscal note. So anyway, yeah.
Senator Hughes, I did have a question. Okay. Thank you again for presenting this bill. And I know there's a handful of folks who would probably testify to this too, but I just had a question. This is specifically relating to prohibitions on state agencies. I'm curious in your cybersecurity discussions whether you thought about the ability of private companies or even publicly held companies to store biometric identification and things like that.
If we, we're for state use, we do have something in the bill that if a state agency contracts for an AI model or system, multi-factor authentication would be required to protect that data. So, and the other thing is we will be talking with the Department of Public Safety as far as what they use. I'm not sure exactly what they're using right now as far as with facial recognition and things like that. I know when I think now when we go to TSA, I'm not sure. Are they using facial recognition? I don't know, but that's not state. So, but we can look more into that, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Please continue.
All right. So if you felt like the beginning part was a little dry, we're getting into a little bit of the fun, scary part, deepfakes in elections. They can be created by generative AI to convincingly imitate elected leaders or other public figures. AI tools can synthesize audio into a person's voice, generate realistic and still visuals, and doing almost anything. And it has caused a proliferation of synthetic media. Poses challenges to the functioning of our constitutional republic when such communications to deprive the public of accurate information it needs, especially when making decisions and elections. We have a couple of examples here that we've seen just recently in the news in the USA. We've heard of the voice altered to sound like President Biden urging voters in New Hampshire to not cast ballots. In Turkey, there was a news outlet that published a deepfake video showing a party endorsing opposition, and a presidential candidate there had to withdraw from the race due to a deepfake sex tape video that was released. In Slovakia, leader Michael Šimečka was depicted as saying he would raise the price of beer and had plans to rig the election. It was later proved to be a deepfake. The Wired was quoted as saying the fact checkers trying to hold the line against disinformation on social media in Slovakia say their experience shows that AI is already advanced enough to disrupt elections while they lack the tools to fight back. So we're going to give a few examples of deepfakes that have been found or created. Here we see a very friendly relationship between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Obviously, these were not true pictures, but they were generated with AI. The next slide, with just a little bit of effort online, we were able to use a template and create an artificial news segment. We'll show you here. So as you can see, there was a little bit of stiffness in there, and most people would kind of figure that's fake. But with given more robust tools, it could be very convincing and could sway elections or other things.
Excuse me, Shelley Hughes, for the record, this was a free tool. So there are tools where you can pay more, and it would be more realistic.
There we go. The next video is one that we generated for a nominal fee where it was more of a face swap. So we took a scene from the famous movie Star Wars and swapped out some of the faces.
Yeah, see if you can tell who they are. I'll just make a comment. The one that was Senator Myers, myself, and Senator Schauer. But Senator Schauer, you could hardly tell it. It still looks like Harrison Ford. But if you look at the nose, you could tell it's Senator Schauer.
I was waiting to see what Darth Vader was going to be.
And then one last one. So as you can see, it wasn't perfect, but it was convincing enough. And again, more robust software would be a lot more convincing.
And so, and one of the challenges, as I even said, let's make one. I didn't want something if I'm going to use myself, right? I didn't want something so convincing that wasn't true that actually could get out there. So that's why we made them so they weren't. You could tell they didn't look perfectly real, and they were so over the top, you'd know that they weren't true. So, but we could have created ones that could have been very damaging. And actually, it's interesting because in some of the countries, I don't remember, it was in Turkey, an opponent didn't just make one that made one candidate didn't just make one to make the opponent look bad, but they did one to make themselves look good and do things that they didn't really do. So I could make a deep fake of me feeding the poor or something that I didn't really show up and help with, that kind of thing. So they can be used in all kinds of ways. So with deep fakes, there is a real concern about squelching First Amendment rights. And so that's going to need to be a discussion. But by using disclosure, at least people would know that something's been manipulated. And the way the bill is set up right now, it's in the APOC section of law. So the current $50 a day penalty would apply without putting that in there. So that's something the committee can think about, whether that is adequate or not. The injunctive relief is important, and we have injunctive relief, or we have the ability in the bill regarding state agency causing a person to suffer harm. That part is in the bill, but we don't have anything related to this. Injunctive relief, it would be tricky, but a court would order that the video come down immediately. You know, it's a month or two from the election. The problem that's going to happen, and this is so new, we don't know how it's going to work. So the judge orders that it comes down. if you actually know who the original source is, but that doesn't mean it didn't get copied and posted elsewhere. So it could be problematic, but it's probably important to have that in there. If it's just been posted by one and you know who it is, the judge could order it come down. So that is kind of what we have, and we've got some pretty expert people online. I'm by no means an expert. I'm just interested in learning probably like all of you about this, but the folks online might be able to answer questions. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great.
Yeah, we thank you. We will take a brief at ease. Okay, I'll call the Senate State Affairs Committee back to order. We appreciate both of you being here, and if you just remain in place, we do have, first we'll just open it up to any committee questions. We also have several folks who are online as subject matter experts who are on Teams, and so I'd like to get to them, I think, first, unless there's any questions people have now. Okay. So, hearing none, and we also have Heather Hebden, again, from Alaska Public Offices Commission, and Ian Walsh from Legislative Legal Services. Let's see. We will go first to invited testimony. We have several folks who are on Teams. The first person that we have on our list is supposed to be Spence Purnell. Spence is the Director of Technology and Policy at the Reason Foundation. Prior to joining Reason, Spence worked as Director of Business Development at Florida Startup Dealers United and is an analyst for the Florida's Executive Office of the Governor. Spence graduated from Stetson University with a bachelor's degree in political science and is working on an MPA at Florida State University. Welcome to the committee, Spence.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, for having me. I think that I'd like to say I really applaud the sponsor and the committee for tackling a challenging issue, and we agree that it's disappointing that there isn't a federal framework, and I guess that's true across a range of issues. So it's not surprising that states are stepping in to fill that policy void. And I think SB 177 does a lot of positive things, and a lot of them have been mentioned. And I know there's a lot of speakers, so I won't take a ton of time going into detail about a lot of these. But I think specifically addressing state use of AI. And as the bill kind of lays out, conducting more or less a SWOT analysis, identifying opportunities, but also threats of how the state could be using citizen data. I really applaud that. And I think that that's an important thing that not every state has done yet. So I think that part is really good. I also think that the third section that the sponsors presented about civil liability is really good. And in our view, good civil liability can a lot of times, prevent rules and regulations that might be unnecessary, as that can, address real harms as they arise. And if there's repeated issues, then statute can come in after and kind of permanently seal some of those cracks, rather than trying to pave the entire road first, so to speak. So I think that, really, really excited about, seeing what some of the state agencies can do with this, and maybe also some potential threats that might not have been realized yet. I think that in terms of the definitions and the deepfake portion of the bill, there's certainly some improvements and refinements that we would like to see to that language. But I think certainly there's a range of action that states can take, you know, and maybe at the more extreme end, just banning technology or banning the use of it. So the fact that this bill only requires a notification, again, I think that there are some refinements and some improvements that could be made nonetheless. But I think that the fact that it limits it to a requirement is a really positive step and leans more toward the, you know, less invasive side. And so I think anytime policy can lean that way, it's a good thing. So again, even though there's some things that could be improved about the bill, there's lots of positive language here. And, you know, I guess I'll just conclude by saying that, you know, I encourage the committee to take time to do more research and, you know, truly understand this technology. There's even some language in here like natural language processing and, you know, computational systems that could use further redefinition, you know, defining. And I think that, you know, the discussion about generative AI and different types of AI kind of goes down that road. So it sounds like there might already be some, you know, ideas as to how that could be changed. But I think it underlines the idea that, you know, this is a pretty quickly evolving technology, and something that, you know, I'm not an engineer myself either. So something that I'm learning about all the time as well. I'm trying to keep an open mind about what it is and how it actually works. And, you know, all of us do our best to understand it. So, yeah, I just think in situations like this with the new and complex and confusing technology, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to just want to squash it out. So I applaud the sponsor for recognizing that there's a real business concern here, as well as other concerns. So just continue to learn about the topic and, you know, address it in appropriate manner. But yeah, very excited about some of the language that I see here and very happy to work with the sponsor and answer any questions that the committee have or provide any information that can be educational for the group. So again, thank you for having me. And yeah, happy to work with anyone that wants to chat.
Great, thank you, Mr. Purnell. I did actually have a question because you did mention sort of the definition section of the bill relating to deepfake and what a computational processing technique would be. You know, I think Adobe Photoshop, for instance, we've used it lots of times, but most recently they talk about their AI filtering for all sorts of different elements. Would that be considered a computational processing technique? So if I were to make myself taller and thinner, would that be something that would be considered deepfake?
It's a good question. I think that that's definitely the downside of trying to put a definition on something like this, because you're going to kind of have there's always been something that's going to slip out. And it's true. I think that, you know, the point that you're making is true for a lot of technologies. You know, even Google search uses AI to help, you know, generate the results for you. So, I mean, you could even argue that spell check in Google Docs is a form of automated or, you know, computational processing or a natural language system. So, you know, I think that you definitely risk capturing much more technology than you intend to by including something like computational processing techniques is likely too broad and would need to be refined down or defined again later in statute. But I think, yes, that is a real concern. Again, and it might not necessarily be a bad thing that the state takes inventory of all the types of artificial intelligence, whatever that ends up being defined. I mean, it might not inherently be a bad thing that the state takes inventory of all the AI that it's using, but I do think that there could be some refinement to the language that currently exists.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Purnell. We have Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I just want to clarify. So the computational processing technique, that is in part of the definition having to do with deepfake. And actually, we were going to recommend, because one of the things you want to do is you want to be technology neutral. You know, when I worked on unmanned aircraft policy, part of it was, aviation in general. So you don't make a special rule for a certain kind of airplane or a certain kind of unmanned aircraft, right? And so for this, when you're talking about a deepfake actually wouldn't necessarily have to be produced by generative AI. It could be produced manually. It could be produced with Photoshop. So we're going to suggest you, Mr. Chair, on page 2, line 5, probably take out of similar and greater complexity so that it would be technology neutral and just would not be just generative AI. But as far as state agency use, because they use so much rule-based AI and have been for decades, having them inventory that would be a tremendous amount of work and extremely expensive. So we might want to limit that to generative AI. So in the one case, we're being technology neutral on the deepfake, but in state agency use, we might want to focus on generative AI. Of course, that's up to the committee.
Great. Thank you, Senator Hughes. And once again, thank you, Mr. Purnell, for being online. If you just remain online, we might have questions in the future. We just have three other folks. I'll introduce next Mr. Daniel Castro. Mr. Castro is the director of the Center for Data Innovation and vice president of the Informatic Technology and Innovation Foundation. Mr. Castro writes and speaks on a variety of issues related to information technology and internet policy, including data, privacy, security, intellectual property, internet governance, e-governance, and accessibility for folks with disabilities. His work's been quoted and cited in numerous media outlets, including the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, NPR, USA Today, and Bloomberg News. And I'd just like to welcome Mr. Castro to the Senate State Affairs Committee.
Thank you, Chair Kawasaki, so much for the opportunity to share some feedback on SB 177. So I've submitted kind of more detailed written testimony on the entire bill, but I thought I'd just spend a few, a minute or two talking about the deepfakes portion, which I think is top of mind for so many people. We've really seen rapid advances in generative AI over the past year. And so I think that's why people are rightfully concerned that bad actors are going to exploit the technology to create these deepfakes. And we've already seen harmful effects, as the presentation earlier made clear, from the fake, explicit images of celebrities to disinformation about politicians. And we know that deepfakes have the potential to harm and influence elections. Deepfakes can be used to harm a candidate's reputation. It can be used to mislead voters. It can also make voters simply not believe their eyes. And so they start distrusting all media, including legitimate content that shows them the truth. And so one way to address this risk, and we've seen a number of states move down this path, is by updating state election laws to make it unlawful for campaigns or other political organizations to knowingly distribute materially deceptive media that uses a person's likeness to manipulate voters without a clear and conspicuous disclosure that the content they're seeing is fake. And so I would say any of these state laws should really adhere to 5 key principles. So the first one is treat both AI and non-AI generated fake media equally. So for example, you can think about a deceptive video about Sarah Palin. It would be a problem regardless of whether it was produced using AI or somebody hired Tina Fey to go out and just impersonate her. Second, we want to allow for beneficial uses of AI created content in elections. So as was just mentioned earlier, not all AI generated content is necessarily deceptive, especially when it's done with the candidate's consent. This will be, what most people start using to edit videos in the future. say you're filming a speech and you flub a word, and you, instead of having to re-record the entire speech, you can just go in and make a simple edit. That's what this technology is using and doing. And so what you want to avoid is any kind of requirements for disclosure that inadvertently mandate disclaimers on virtually all media, because that risks desensitizing voters to these types of notices. Third, you know, when it comes to mandatory disclosures, the focus should be on warning the public about deceptive media itself, rather than explicitly pointing out that you're using AI. So, for example, in California, the approach in that law is to state, you know, this image or this audio has been manipulated. Just full stop there. And that's more informative and less stigmatizing than specifically saying, you know, this was created using AI. Fourth, I'd say, you know, you have to have some kind of robust enforcement mechanism. So what we've seen is that you need swift consequences, there are swift consequences for spreading deepfakes, especially when you see this happening very close to elections. And so, you know, candidates need to have a way to seek injunctive relief against an organization like an opposing campaign that's distributing this content, as well as seek penalties for harms. Now, we have to recognize that we're never going to be able to stop kind of the what happened in the past would be whisper campaigns, right? Individuals putting things on social media. No laws can be able to address that. What we're talking about is how can you stop campaigns, legitimate campaigns, from using this technology unlawfully or illicitly. And finally, I'd say, you know, the legislative focus should primarily be on the political organizations or individuals that are creating and disseminating deepfakes, not any of the intermediaries like email providers or social media platforms or anything else that might be used to distribute the content. And the reason is that, you know, there are a lot of states that are considering deepfake laws. And so it's important that we avoid creating a patchwork of conflicting state laws for all these different online platforms. So, you know, in short, you know, looking forward to see, you know, this draft, you know, continue to be refined and improved. I think it's great to see that you're talking about this issue. This is an issue that will only become more important as we get closer and closer to Election Day this year. And as the technology continues to improve, because what we've seen is that the growth rate and the ease with which this technology can be used is going very quickly. And it doesn't require significant technical expertise. So I just ask that as you're considering legislation in this space, you consider these principles as a way to address public concerns without constraining many of the beneficial uses of AI.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Castro. I did have a question because you did mention on, I think it was your fourth bullet regarding or having a enforcement and how that enforcement's done. You know, the scenario is you get the October surprise, which is 4 days prior to the Tuesday on election. And so what has worked or what could work potentially in that case?
Yeah, well, so this is where you have to differentiate the legitimate campaigns versus the illegitimate ones. You know, we have to recognize that there are going to be, you know, Russian attackers that are going to be creating deepfakes that could influence elections, and none of these state laws or federal laws are going to prevent those types of activity. They're not going to prevent, you know, the kind of dark ops campaign activity either. What they can prevent, though, is any legitimate campaign from using deepfakes or robocalls for planting and paying for television advertisements or internet advertisements. That's what you can focus on. And, you know, there's two ways to make sure it's effective. One is having that swift injunctive relief so that the affected candidate can quickly get an ad taken down, for example, from a TV station. And the second is to have these, you know, civil penalties so that, you know, they're going to suffer and have to pay substantially damages if they've injured someone's reputation. That has a deterrent effect so it doesn't happen in the future.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Castro. Are there further questions for Mr. Castro before we move on to the next speaker? Okay. Thank you very much. I'll introduce the next speaker in line. The next speaker that we have is Nate Persily. Nate Persily is the James B. McClatchy Professor of Law at Stanford Law School with appointments in the Department of Political Science, Communication, and I can't read that, FSI. Prior to joining Stanford, Professor Persily taught at Columbia and the University of Pennsylvania Law School and as a visiting professor at Harvard, New York University, Princeton, and the University of Amsterdam, and the University of Melbourne. And Mr. Persily has a PhD from UC Berkeley, a JD in Stanford Law, and a lot of degrees. We just wanted to thank you for being on, Mr. Persily.
Well, thank you very much. And it's a pleasure to be here. And I thank the committee for its attention to this matter. Every state is going to be dealing with this issue soon enough. And the more intellectual resources we have dedicated to this problem, the better. And I applaud Senator Hughes for taking the initiative here. I don't want to repeat what's been said, but let me emphasize that AI has had its Taylor Swift moment, as was mentioned before. And that is really, I think, the opening silo of what we're going to see in the coming months, particularly as it gets converted into political expression. So that while, as was noted before, there's certainly examples around the world and some here in the U.S. of the use of deepfake technology, it is going to blossom and multiply quite quickly. I want to just, let me just talk about the sort of the who, what, and where of deepfakes and how to regulate them, because I think this piece of legislation takes a particular approach, and I want to sort of identify those different dimensions and also think more broadly about where you might go with this. First is who should be regulated by a deepfake regulation? Should it be the creator, whether those are candidates, campaigns, outside actors, the speaker, the transmitter or forwarder of that image or other kinds of deepfake technology, or should it be the intermediary, such as a company? And I agree with Mr. Castro that the focus in this bill on the creators or the speakers, I think, is quite important. We want to make sure that it is not sort of regulating just individual Gmail kinds of communications, but also the ones that are going to cause great danger to the political process. So focusing on who's regulated, and then secondly, where does the regulation happen? Because by its terms, this could be a law that would affect, for example, deepfake creation anywhere in the U.S. that then has on the internet that then would implicate a particular candidate, whether in Alaska or a national candidate. Third, what is regulated, particularly in this case, what action is regulated? Does one focus on any communication, what we call organic communication, as we think about it in online, or should we focus on advertising? Many of the existing efforts that I'm seeing around the country are focusing on advertising because the First Amendment concerns there are somewhat lessened, or just all organic communication, which could include me putting something up about a candidate, say on a Facebook or Twitter post. Related is not just what action is regulated, but what type of content is regulated. And there was some discussion that you just concluded about how to define what is AI or what is a deepfake. Let me encourage you all to look at the law that tomorrow will be passed in the European Union, the AI Act, which has a series of definitions here. Not that the EU has any monopoly on wisdom on this, but they have spent the last few years trying to come up with definitions that I think could be modified for particular contexts. Defining the deepfake or AI, I think, is important, as was suggested before. Should it include what we call even cheap fake technology like Photoshop? But then which universe of deep fakes are you regulating? So this bill looks particularly at what I might call libelous deep fakes, or ones that are intended to damage the reputation of candidates or parties. Other deep fake laws are looking at things like deep fakes about the voting process. For example, if someone puts up a false video about what's happening in a polling place, or issue advocacy and the deepfakes there. Fourth, how should a law like this deal with enforcement? As was talked about before, I won't belabor it, but how this type of thing will be monitored, whether it will lead to enforcement, you know, criminal enforcement by the state, or whether it would be a locus for civil liability. And then finally, when should it apply? And I think this is something that people don't ordinarily think about, but there are analogies in campaign finance law, especially if you're limiting it to candidate campaigns. Is this the kind of thing which would perpetually apply to candidates and potentially, you know, all incumbents who currently hold office? Or, as with, say, the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act that is federal law, would it apply to a period before a campaign where you could identify the candidates, and it would also make it a little better tailored for First Amendment purposes? And so the First Amendment concerns, and I'll just conclude by putting my sort of law professor hat on here, are sort of vagueness and overbreath, which is going to plague any law like this, as well as concerns about content-based and viewpoint-based discrimination, because this regulates, like I said before, libelous deep fakes. But the key feature here, as was stated by Senator Hughes and others, is that this focuses on what we'll call a disclaimer for communications. And as much as Citizens United, for example, struck down a lot of the campaign finance laws that were at issue there, it did uphold disclaimer requirements. And so thinking about the analogy from the campaign finance context to the deepfake context is, I think, quite important, because disclosure doesn't raise all of the same constitutional concerns that generalized bans will. But as I said, I want to thank the committee and Senator Hughes for inviting me to testify here. I think that this is an area which is going to occupy you, as it will all state legislatures over the coming years, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Super. Thanks, Mr. Persily. We do have a question from Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for that presentation. So the way the bill's currently written, it only requires a disclaimer if the deepfake is intended to injure the reputation of a candidate or party or otherwise deceive a voter. And I think those are very, for many people, might be very subjective things. And I'm wondering if it's not just a better policy legally to just say, if it's manipulated by AI, then you just include the disclaimer. And I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Right. I think that does make some sense. But part of the challenge here, especially if this is literally regulating all communications about potential candidates, is that the sort of more narrow it is, the more likely it might be upheld. And so as was stated before, and I should emphasize something that I think, as Senator Hughes mentioned when she was talking about something like Excel spreadsheets, every digital platform that we are using right now has AI in it, right? So we need to kind of put that aside, that it's all there. And so whether it's a on your phone when you if you look at the Google ads for phones where they erase red eye, or you can alter your face and things like that, there is a risk that there will end up being disclaimers for literally all imagery on the internet. And so you want to try to, and if that happens, then people, I think, will become kind of numb to these kinds of disclaimers, because everything will have some kind of AI tag to it. And so I think the rationale here is to limit it to the kinds of deepfakes that people are worried about. But as you said, one of the ways to avoid the viewpoint-based discrimination claim is to enlarge it to, you know, political communications generally. And if it's going to be about reputational injury in its current format, you may want to really borrow from the words that we use for libel about reckless disregard for the truth and actual malice. But that's something that you could deal with later on.
Thank you very much, Mr. Persily. Are there further questions before we move on to one of our last speakers? Okay. Hearing none, we have Mr. Robert Weissman. Mr. Robert Weissman is the president of Public Citizen, a staunch public interest advocate and activist, as well as an expert on corporate and government accountability. Weissman's appeared on CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, and Marketplace Radio, and has been published and quoted in publications such as The Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post. We've had Public Citizen at an earlier hearing, and we just wanted to once again welcome you to the committee, Mr. Weissman.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate being with you. I wanted to really thank Senator Hughes for her leadership and for the committee as well. I think these are really urgent issues. And it's important on the one hand to get the details right, but it's also important to approach these issues, I think, with a sense of urgency because they are fast approaching, and failing to take action is going to lead to some really damaging consequences, I think, foreseeably in Alaska as well as around the world. We are strong. We think very highly of the approach in Senate Bill 177. I'm going to talk primarily about the deepfake portion of it. I just want to appreciate the breadth of the bill and both prongs of it. I'm going to resist the urge to sort of build on the comments from the prior witnesses and just say three quick things. The first is just to reiterate that the political deepfake moment is upon us. The examples we've seen so far in the U.S. and around the world are harbingers of what's going to come in the absence of regulation. I think it's really important to understand it's a certainty that if there aren't rules in place, political actors of all political stripes, forget about Russia or foreign powers, all political operatives are going to say this is a valuable tool. They're not going to be constrained from using something that's legal. They're going to go ahead and do it, and it's going to perpetuate the problems we've talked about, the possibility of a late game shift in election, the possibility of people doubting everything they see, the possibility of candidates denying things that are true by labeling them as deepfakes. All those things are a near certainty in the absence of government action. Second point is we can actually do something about it, and I think that's what this bill effectively aims to do. And from our point of view, the most important thing is to establish in law and through social norms that political deepfakes without a disclosure are not okay. We should assume that political operatives will use the tools that are available to them if they are legal. But if they're not legal, we should assume that most people will follow the law and not engage, not use these tools in ways that are defined to be illegal. So establishing the standard as the bill does is the most important thing. Disclosure is the right approach, I think, in light of the First Amendment and the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this space. There might be a different way to go about it in a different world, but in the world we live in, against the background of existing Supreme Court jurisprudence, I think the kinds of disclosure that's mandated in the current bill is exactly the right way to go. The third thing I just want to say, building on some of the prior comments, things that we would emphasize to strengthen the deepfake portion of the bill are to focus on enforcement. I'm not sure $50 a day is probably $50 for a contravention of the law is sufficient. I think that's worth looking at. More importantly, I think, is to establish the right of injunctive relief, because the most important thing is to make sure there's fast action, and any regulatory agency, whichever agency would be in charge of enforcing this, we can assume they're going to operate in good faith and do their best they can, but they're not going to operate with the speed of light. And an impacted candidate is going to operate with the speed of light and have every incentive in the world to seek quick action. So establishing a right for injunctive relief is, we think, really important. Last, to strengthen the bill from any possible First Amendment challenge, I think specifying that the use of deepfakes for satire is not included would not be covered by the bill would be important. The Supreme Court gives a lot of deference and import to satire. You just don't want to get caught up in that and have the bill's really strong disclosure provisions defeated by failing to take that into account. So those are our comments. We've got lots more thoughts on this, but those are the primary things. States across the country are moving on this. So Alaska is going to be in really good company. I think we're working really hard to have federal legislation as well. And although there's bipartisan support for that, it would be a mistake for sure to count on Congress acting quickly on this or really any other matters. So the buck is really with you all, and we appreciate your leadership on this, and happy to answer questions and help in any way we can.
Super. Thank you, Mr. Weissman. Are there questions, Mr. Weissman, right now? Actually, I guess I do have a question, Mr. Weissman, when you're talking about other states, and, you know, our legislature just started back up here a couple weeks ago. I know that Senator Hughes has been working on this bill for several months before that. Are there states that are ahead of the game as far as deployment of AI legislation to prevent sort of what we're seeing could happen here in 2024?
I think there are five states that now have laws on the books prohibiting political deepfakes without disclosure. Michigan was the last one of them, passed legislation towards the end of last year. Other states are in the same situation as you are, just restarting and taking this up. But we are now maintaining a tracker. At least more than two dozen states have bills introduced in addition to those five and are moving forward. I think the New Mexico House of Representatives passed legislation yesterday, I think. So this is moving across the country, but you're still in the forefront.
Thank you, Mr. Weissman. And actually, just a specific question, because it was brought up at the last hearing. There was the deepfake in New Hampshire a couple Tuesdays ago. It didn't say this is Joe Biden, and it didn't say anything like that. It just sounded like him. And it was his likeness, and I think that's obviously why it was utilized, and I don't know who it was targeting, but, I mean, it definitely had an impact, but we were looking at the legislation that we have here, legislation we've been working on, and it actually wouldn't have prevented that particular thing from happening, from occurring. Is there something where we could prevent that from happening or have some sort of penalty for, you know, basically, what happened was deceptive, but it didn't look like it was against the laws that we have on the books.
I should look more carefully to see if I'm not sure that you couldn't argue that, but in that case, and we would strongly favor doing that. But it's also the case, I think, I don't know about this for Alaska, but I think probably in Alaska and for sure for most states, there are laws already on the books prohibiting untrue information, dissuading people from voting. They're telling them the wrong place for an election, or the date has been changed, or telling them not to vote. So I don't know if that's the case in Alaska, but it would have been the case, and it is the case in New Hampshire. Even in the absence of a deepfake bill in New Hampshire, what occurred there is illegal. Of course, we don't know who did it, so it's going to be hard to hold them accountable. But adding something like that was specific about relating to the use of deepfakes to deter people from voting or mislead them about when an election is or whether they should vote, I think that would make all the sense in the world.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Mr. Weissman before we return back to the committee? We also have online, we also have Mr. Castro, Daniel Castro, and Spence Purnell, who are still online. I think we still have Ledge Legal and Director Hebden from Alaska Public Office Commission, too. Are there any questions for any of those folks?
I have a comment.
And, okay, we have Senator Hughes. Go ahead.
Like I said, this is a work in progress, and it's probably, you know, I guess it maybe makes me look kind of bad that I have a bill that needs so much work, but it's so important to start the conversation. But I will say there is a section of the bill I just want to draw to your attention that I believe needs to be fixed. And it has to do with state agency use and data that would be hosted. And there's a list of countries that would be considered hostile. And Ledge Legal took it from a federal piece of legislation that has not yet passed. But in speaking with the chief information officer, they actually have a policy that refers to a dynamic list on the state departments. And so I think changing that section and using some kind of language referring to the list that the State Department keeps might be wise.
Great. Thank you, Senator Hughes. Are there Any questions? There's definitely a lot to think about, and I appreciate the speakers who are on to testify before the committee. We probably will have a lot more questions as we delve closer into this legislation and closer into the issues of artificial intelligence. Are there any last and final questions before we set this bill aside? Okay, hearing none. Once again, thank you, gentlemen, for being online. We will now set Senate Bill 177 over for a future hearing, and we'll be working with you trying to figure out. Senator Hughes, did you have a question?
I just want to thank the committee, and I want to thank those. I feel like we had a really high level of experts that were able to join us, and it's evening and some of the locations where they are, and I just really appreciate them being willing to hang on and speak with us. It's very much appreciated, and thank you to Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hughes. Okay, well, that concludes the meeting for today. Our next meeting is scheduled for Tuesday, February 6th. We will hear Senate Bill 151, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Report, sponsored by Senator Donnie Olson. Without further ado, this meeting is adjourned, and the time is 5 p.m.